Let me add just one further word about the Roman Catholic view. The Roman Catholic view, as you know, is a sacramental system. In the Baltimore Catechism, question number 109 asks, what is grace? And answers, grace is a supernatural gift of God bestowed on us through the merits of Jesus Christ for our salvation. Question 304 asks, what is a sacrament? A sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. And there are seven sacraments: baptism, confirmation, Holy Eucharist, penance, extreme unction, holy orders, and matrimony. Of course, the three that most directly relate to the application of salvation to an individual's life are baptism, Holy Eucharist, and penance. The sacraments give sanctifying grace. In the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, which Roman Catholics are strongly encouraged to receive every week, in fact, grace is given that is in order to a holy life. So question 377 asks, why is it well to receive Holy Communion often, even daily? It is well to receive Holy Communion often, even daily, because this intimate union with Jesus Christ, the source of all holiness and the giver of all graces, is the greatest aid to a holy life. The Roman Catholic theology is a sacramental system, and you receive grace through the sacraments. One might ask, don't you receive grace through prayer in Roman Catholicism? Well, prayer is not a sacrament, okay? The sacraments are those institutions that God has ordained to give grace. So in baptism, you receive saving grace initially. If you commit mortal sin, you regain it through penance. But it's through Holy Eucharist, that sacrament, that you constantly receive supplies of grace which are in order to a holy life. So remember that grace comes through the sacraments. If it be asked, as I mentioned, isn't prayer a means of grace? I suspect that since it's not a sacrament, that what is going on there is that prayer, rather than being a channel of grace from God to us, prayer is rather something in which our desires are brought into line with God's will, and that there's no grace that is bestowed. There's no grace that comes through prayer or the reading of the word. Now, indulgences may be granted for the reading of the word, but that's not a means of grace either. So remember that it's entirely a sacramental system, and the sacraments, particularly those I mentioned, baptism, penance, and the Holy Eucharist, are all related to a holy life. Bill. No, the sacrament which they call extreme unction, that sacrament is really it's not the way even many Roman Catholics conceive of it. Something that you receive upon dying as a sort of a last rite. It's actually intended to give strength so that you might recover. Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah. That's the purpose of it. Yeah. The purpose is not to give you a final... I mean, you can, of course, receive absolution and penance from a final confession, but that's not what this is all about. Extreme unction. Here's what they say. Question 443. What is extreme unction? Extreme unction is the sacrament which, through the anointing with blessed oil by the priest and through his prayer, gives health and strength to the soul and sometimes to the body when we are in danger of death from sickness, accident, or old age. It's really nothing to do with a final absolution or a final penance or something of that sort. That's a sacrament of, again, penance, which involves confession and absolution. Yeah. Tom.
What does that mean then, to give health and strength to the soul?
Okay, that part of it, I guess they mean that when you're very sick, you feel very weak. And that weak feeling, of course, spills over to the soul as well. And this strengthens the soul, either for death or recovery. I mean, if you're going to die, it strengthens you so that you die strong in faith. It helps you that way. Yeah. There was another question. Jack? Well, unction is the anointing with oil representative of the Holy Spirit. And extreme is when you're in extremity. Yeah. There was another question. Okay, I just wanted to mention that so as to make sure that the emphasis was rightly placed on Roman Catholic view as a sacramental system. Charles Grandison Finney. Now, you notice the diagrams at the bottom look strikingly similar. There's a reason for that. Let's read what it says on page 157. In Charles G. Finney's view of entire sanctification, God has always held man responsible only for what he is fully able to do. Ability conditions responsibility. In addition, sin and holiness are not natures, dispositions, or states, but only inhere in actions. There's no such thing as a sinful or holy nature. There are only sinful or holy actions. In the preface to his lectures on systematic theology, Finney says, "Especially do I urge to their logical consequences the two admissions that the will is free, and that sin and holiness are voluntary acts of mind." Now he takes those two principles and he runs them throughout his whole theology. The will is free, sin and holiness are voluntary acts of mind. He then says, "What I've said on moral law and on the foundation of moral obligation is the key to the whole subject. Whoever masters and understands these can readily understand all the rest." He says they're voluntary acts of mind. Finney, I've read his lectures on revivals of religion. I've read his sermons on gospel themes and his lectures to professing Christians, all of which are good-sized books. And they have a lot of good stuff in them. A lot of good stuff. If only he hadn't written this. Because, frankly, as you go through this, I mean, he takes those principles and he runs them right through, right to the ground. He does things you would not believe with the atonement, with justification, with natural ability, with regeneration, with moral depravity. He does things you would not believe. The only way, to do that is to look, you know, look at what he says. Read it for yourself. Under sanctification, the doctrine of sanctification, page 405. Sanctification, then, is nothing more nor less than entire obedience for the time being to the moral law. You say, does he really mean that? Yes, he does. Entire obedience to the moral law. That's what sanctification is. In this discussion, I shall use the term entire sanctification to designate a state of confirmed and entire consecration of body, soul, and spirit, or of the whole being, to God. Confirmed not in the sense that a soul entirely sanctified cannot sin, but that as a matter of fact, he does not and will not sin. And a soul entirely sanctified, as a matter of fact, does not sin and will not sin. Entire sanctification, as I understand the term, is identical with entire and continued obedience to the law of God. You say, does he really mean that? Yes, he really means that. Then you say, what does he really mean by what he really means? But entire sanctification is entire and continued obedience to the law of God. The question is, what is the law of God? Okay. Page 407. It is plain. Well, it is self-evident that entire obedience to God's law is possible on the ground of natural ability. Now, that sentence could have come out of Pelagius. It is plain that all the law demands is the exercise of whatever strength we have in the service of God. Now, as entire sanctification consists in perfect obedience to the law of God, and as the law requires nothing more than the right use of whatever strength we have, it is, of course, forever settled that a state of entire sanctification is attainable in this life on the ground of natural ability. So then he said, an angel is bound to exercise an angel's strength, a man the strength of a man, a child the strength of a child. It comes to every moral being in the universe just as he is, where he is, and requires not that he should create new powers or possess other powers than he has, but such as his powers are, they should all be used with the utmost perfection and constancy for God. Jack.
What if I feel like, you know, the ability of God is giving you to that level that I just feel murdered, you know, I'm in terror of sacrifice for us again. I mean, how can he change the rather subjective, what he cut off God's laws at the point that I'm actually constantly given my ability?
Okay, let's put it this way. Up here, we'll call this
the objective law of God. Here is one man, here's another man, here's another man, here's another man, here's another man. This man is responsible to do what he is able to do. This man is responsible to do what he is able to do. This one responsible to do what he is able to do. This one responsible to do what he is able to do. And this one, what he is able to do. If this person reaches this level, what he's able to do, he has fulfilled the law of God. He has done what he's fully able naturally to do, and he's achieved a state of sanctification, entire sanctification, if he continues in it. Of course, continues means he has to do that moment by moment. But a person is responsible to do only what he's able to do. And that varies with the individual, what he's able to do. So this is not what he's responsible to do up here. He's responsible to do what he's able to do. That's the law of God for him. So that varies with the individual. Bill, and then Stephen. You don't see much of it, or it's very veiled in these three books that I mentioned. In the Sermons on Gospel Themes and the Lectures to Professing Christians, it's very veiled there. You hardly see it. It's after you read this and you go back there, you say, can I see intimations of it here? And the answer is yes. But you wouldn't have noticed it, I think, if you had read those books first and not read this.
The implications of this are positively prominent.
I know.
And if he represented that, then saying revivals means something far less than positive.
Okay. That's it's very unpopular to say that, of course.
Well, I mean,
you understand.
I understand. I knew that.
Yeah.
But isn't that the line of
interpretation? I would think so. Yes. I would think so. Well. There are some things we can say, and there are other things that seem to be somewhat conflicting in terms of his own life and in terms of some of the results of his ministry. That can be explored further. However, let me just mention on page 157 these four stages. In all four stages of man's spiritual history, man's nature looks the same. Before the fall, mankind obeyed all of God's commands. After the fall, man turned from obedience. After regeneration, man again does what he ought to do, but imperfectly. And after entire sanctification, man once again simply obeys all of God's commands. No man is responsible for some supposed high standard of legal perfection. Rather, each man is held responsible for what he individually is able to do. If he reaches this personally adjusted standard, he achieves entire sanctification in this life. Stephen.
In that is a real contradiction.
Which?
In that last statement, that once again, man simply obeys all of God's commands, but he's only responsible to the, well, this is what confuses me with this chart, but if we're only responsible to be sanctified to the degree which we are able to obey God's law, then what about the areas where we're not able to obey God's law? And based on biblical definition, any falling short of the law is sin. So, it seems to me that it's not sin.
Well, except unless you say, this is not the standard to which we're responsible.
how do you obey all of God's commands?
You obey God's commands that are addressed to you, and God's commands are to love God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself, and you're fully able to do that, or he wouldn't address those commands to you.
Is that all of God's commands?
Well, that's the sum of it. You can detail those further, but that's the sum of it.
Is it possible that he simply doesn't detail further?
No, he got into a lot of application, personal and social. He got into a lot of social application. Boy, oh boy. Yes, David. That's a good question. What you're able to do.
To love the words of God and to love your neighbor, I mean, you know, I'm able to sit home and watch TV all day and not bother them.
Yeah,
or is it I can go out and help my neighbor besides I have legs and I can mow the lawn to them, you know. What would be how would you respond to that?
Well, he did say some things that have objective reference. Obviously, he denounced the liquor traffic, boy. He did make application in the objective realm where he was able to say this is wrong and that's wrong, that sort of thing. And in his personal life, he certainly seems to have lived a life that was separated from at least outward forms of sin. So people didn't find fault with his personal life, even his harshest critics. Yeah, well, sure, sure. Exactly. Bill.
It looks like, if it's just looking back to it, it's a basic, really basic problem in Jimmy's theology, I don't think everything else flows, is that man's nature looks the same.
Yeah, it's his view of sin, what sin has done to man's nature and what sin is.
He doesn't believe then that sin impacted man's nature. He believes that man simply disobeys and now he simply obeys. And it does not affect, affective action is not his essential nature.
He said the doctrine of constitutional sin, that is, of a sinful nature, is from the nether pit. That's pretty clear. No, he didn't. Well, he may have read some, yeah. Jack.
Would this stuff come out in his revival campaigns?
Well, as I said to Bill, it seems to be more veiled in his sermons. Seems to be more veiled. Well, this is, I'm quoting, this is lectures on systematic theology. This is the theoretical underpinning. I mentioned his lectures on revivals of religion, which is a classic. His sermons on gospel themes. Boy, that's powerful. It has so many wonderful illustrations in it that are usable. And his lectures to professing Christians.
They sounded like the revival techniques.
Yeah, emphases at least, yeah.
Do we have actual texts in the sermons?
Well, those are his books. I don't know how many of his sermons are transcribed from the time. I know that was done a lot. It was done for Spurgeon, for example. I know it was. Yeah.
In that.
Yeah. Bill.
Jimmy claimed an experience very similar to Wesley's experience, where Jimmy, Wesley says, because the Elder gave me something about, I find my heart strangely warm.
Yeah.
and not have asked for everything.
Yes.
And can't explain the experience like that. I can't remember what I read, but I never read it.
Yeah. It was early in his experience.
Yes.
And it was out in the woods.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen.
Was someone who seems like a fundamental heresy, I would say.
That's pretty strong.
How can we say he really grasped the essence of the gospel? He doesn't even understand the simple nature.
All I can say to that is, thank God that He's sovereign. God uses a lot of imperfection to accomplish His will. He uses all kinds of instruments. Frankly, I look at some of my early sermons and I shudder.
But you have developed, we hope.
I hope so, yes. But I'm talking about early in my career. Yeah. Jack.
I heard about a little bit about how getting into the world, eventually, you come into sin, which you think came first is that your sanctification is filling up. And which one influenced which? Or, I mean, is this the foundational thing that makes getting screwball into the atomic? They go back to that. How does it, you know, how do they relate? Do they, do you think they sort of pop up individually?
I don't know the psychology of how it actually developed.
I mean, is there a sense of these drugs like this?
I get the impression that there were some things that were really logically prior and basic, and it's those things he mentions in the preface. Beyond that, I don't get a feel for the order of the way things develop.
If this can be a fact, is that the fact that we need to get a step from it?
Now, we should start on John and Charles Wesley. John and Charles Wesley. Let me read a little bit, quote a little bit, before we go into the theoretics of it. This is John Wesley, a plain account of Christian perfection. The best introduction I know of to his view. A plain account of Christian perfection. This represents Charles' views as well, his brother, the hymn writer. John and Charles worked closely together. And he quotes a lot of Charles's hymns in this book, you know, to support. Wesley's theology is really in his hymns as well as in his theoretics. They're in his sermons and in his hymns. They're really plain. Well, you can trace through this book, because they give you dates, and he runs it date-wise, you can trace his development, which is kind of interesting, starting back with 1739. He says, the first tract I ever wrote expressly on this subject, Christian perfection, was published in the latter end of this year, 1739. I gave it the indifferent title of The Character of a Methodist. In this, I describe a perfect Christian, placing in the front, not as though I had already attained. Now, he quotes part of it. A Methodist is one who loves the Lord his God with all his heart, with all his soul, with all his mind, and with all his strength. God is the joy of his heart and the desire of his soul, which is continually crying, whom have I in heaven but thee? And there is none upon earth whom I desire besides thee. Perfect love having now cast out fear, he rejoices evermore. Yea, his joy is full. On Monday, June 25th, 1744, there was a conference.
they considered the doctrine of sanctification or perfection. Here are questions and answers that were given in this conference. Question, what is it to be sanctified? Answer, to be renewed in the image of God, in righteousness and true holiness. What is implied in being a perfect Christian, the loving God with all our heart and mind and soul? Does this imply that all inward sin is taken away? Undoubtedly. Or how can we be said to be saved from all our uncleanness? Then in August 1st, 1745. Question, when does inward sanctification begin? In the moment a man is justified. Yet sin remains in him, yea, the seed of all sin, till he is sanctified throughout. From that time, a believer gradually dies to sin and grows in grace. That is, from justification until sanctification is throughout. Is this ordinarily given, that is, sanctification throughout, a little before death? Is this ordinarily given till a little before death? It is not, to those who expect it no sooner. Question. Can you show one such example now, that is, of a perfect person, entirely sanctified? Where is he that is thus perfect? Answer. To some that make this inquiry, one might answer, if I knew one here, I would not tell you, for you do not inquire out of love. You are like Herod, you only seek the young child to slay it. But more directly, we answer, there are many reasons why there should be few, if any, indisputable examples. What inconveniences would this bring on the person himself, set as a mark for all to shoot at? And how unprofitable would it be to gainsayers? Were if they hear not Moses and the prophets, Christ and his apostles, neither would they be persuaded that one rose from the dead. I have been the more large in these extracts, because hence it appears beyond all possibility of exception that to this day both my brother and I maintained, one, that Christian perfection is that love of God in our neighbor which implies deliverance from all sin. Two, that this is received merely by faith. Three, that it is given instantaneously in one moment. Four, that we are to expect it not at death, but every moment. That now is the accepted time, now is the day of this salvation. Question, what is Christian perfection? The loving God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. This implies that no wrong temper, none contrary to love, remains in the soul, and that all the thoughts, words, and actions are governed by pure love. Do you affirm that this perfection excludes all infirmities, ignorance, and mistake? I continually affirm quite the contrary, and have always done so. What was the judgment of all our brethren who met at Bristol in August 1758 on this head? It was expressed in these words, everyone may mistake as long as he lives. A mistake in opinion may occasion a mistake in practice. Every such mistake is a transgression of the perfect law. Therefore, every such mistake, were it not for the blood of atonement, would expose to eternal damnation. It follows that even the most perfect have continual need of the merits of Christ, even for their actual transgressions, and may say for themselves as well as for their brethren, forgive us our trespasses. Defects of various kinds are all deviations from the perfect law, and consequently need an atonement. Yet they are not properly sins. Defects are deviations from the perfect law. They need an atonement, but they're not properly sins. Not only sin properly so called, that is a voluntary transgression of a known law. That's the key right there, the definition of what sin is. A voluntary transgression of a known law. Sin properly so called. But sin improperly so called, that is an involuntary transgression of a divine law, known or unknown, needs the atoning blood. See, both kinds of sin, properly called and improperly so called, need atonement. I believe there is no such perfection in this life as excludes these involuntary transgressions. which I apprehend to be naturally consequent on the ignorance and mistakes inseparable from mortality. Therefore, sinless perfection is a phrase I never use, lest I should seem to contradict myself. I believe a person filled with the love of God is still liable to these involuntary transgressions. Such transgressions you may call sin if you please. I do not, for the reasons above mentioned. Well, that's the key right there. How is sin defined? Okay, there I'll stop.